Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. 3 weeks into the new year, sticking to that resolution to exercise more or stop eating sugar or drink less may feel a little extreme. So what do? Shrug your shoulders and reach for another cupcake? Log on to veganlife.com for inspiration. Head to the bookstore to find somebody, anybody, who can guide you to be fitter, happier, and more radiant human being. From the meditations of Marcus Aurelius to Benjamin Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac, people have been reaching for advice on how to be more fully actualized since long before being self-actualized was a term. The writer Jessica Lamb Shapiro set out to explore the $11 billion industry of self-improvement books and seminars and coaching to figure out why people follow them so devoutly, if they work, and what happens when they don't. She's written a new memoir called Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture, and joins us now from New York City. Jessica, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So bring us back to the origins of self-help. You found records back in ancient Egypt, but it is a particularly American fixation. So help us understand that history.
Well, I did find a book of advice from father to son in ancient Egypt, and then I was trying to think outside of the box a little bit and not look at things that were prototypes for self-help, so not necessarily self-help books. So I looked at some ancient Greek texts like Marcus Aurelius, which you mentioned. I looked at parts of the Bible like Proverbs, which gives us advice on how to live. There were etiquette books in the 1600s and 1700s, which I also consider to be prototypes for self-help books. And then self-help as we know it today really took off in the mid-19th century in England, actually. A man named Samuel Smiles wrote a book called Self-Help, which was basically a collection of inspirational stories similar to today's Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Well, we learn more about that Chicken Soup for the Soul franchise and its extremely, extremely successful author when you attend a conference that he gives. He has a kind of formula for how things are successful, and there is a kind of reliance on formula in a lot of self-help books, the inspirational story being one element, and this kind of imperative. You must do things this way. What are some examples of how that works on people?
Well, this was just taken from my own experience at this conference that I went to, where a self-help writer was teaching other self-help writers how to write self-help books. And he just kept telling us what to do, you know, do this, do that, even down to things that didn't really have to do with self-help, things about that we were given these binders with all these instructions and where to go. And I started to feel really comfortable and relaxed, and it really reminded me of being a child, which was kind of the last time that I'd had that experience of somebody really micromanaging my every move. And I started to wonder if that was kind of the appeal of self-help, is that you're sort of returned to this childhood-like state where the rules are very clear and you just understand what you're supposed to do. I think that it causes a lot of anxiety being a grown-up and not always knowing what to do in every situation.
You attended a workshop by one of the authors of the book, The Rules. Now, this was a 1995 book first on how to land a husband. Now it's pretty much a full-blown franchise with a pretty rigid set of absolutes. I'd love you to pick it up from there. What's their formula and what's the success story for someone who follows the rules?
Well, their formula is very similar to what we would call playing hard to get. It involves pretending not to be interested, and it's essentially like a manipulation of the other person where you present yourself as somebody who's distant and aloof, and you kind of cause the other person to, they call it the male is the hunter biologically. So you cause men to sort of hunt you, I suppose, like some sort of animal in the woods, and that will lead to marriage is their supposition. You know, and it may have worked for many people. In this particular instance where I went to the workshop, a woman named Betsy came, and she told a story of how she used the rules. And she said, "I'm the ultimate rules girl because I got married twice in 1 year." And
wow.
I was really surprised by that because I thought, wait, that doesn't sound right. Twice in 1 year, that means you got divorced. That doesn't seem like a success story.
Well, one of the suggestions or one of the rules for the rules is to make sure that all of your self-help books are out of sight if a man is coming over. So it seems like it's promoting a kind of shame at being the kind of person who would need the program that they are selling.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you just want to seem like this completely imperturbable, perfect person, which none of us are. And it seems like, you know, one flaw in that is that at some point you're going to relax and then you're going to reveal your true self. And that might be somebody who likes self-help books or, you know, does any number of potentially undesirable things. And, you know, to me, it seems better to get that stuff out front right in the beginning as opposed to kind of hide that stuff till the very end, because that could have disastrous consequences.
Well, it also seems to me that it's assuming that one can control an outcome. And you write something about that, about this fantasy of omnipotence, of controlling other people. And that's also part of the secret, you know, this idea that we control the universe of possibilities with our own thoughts. Something strikes me as so, you know, wonderfully optimistic about that, but also tragic. Well, what do you see?
I mean, I think that that's part of the reason we turn to self-help books. You know, mostly we turn to self-help books in times of helplessness and sometimes desperation. You usually don't read a self-help book when everything is going great in your life. And one of the things that can be scary about a difficult situation is that you really experience this lack of control. You know, relationship ends, you get fired, you've gained a lot of weight, you don't know how to take it off, and you just don't know how to get control of your life. And one thing that self-help books promise you is that you can regain that control. And very often with relationship books, they promise you even more on top of that, which is that you can control the behavior of another person. You know, you can make a man want to marry you, which if you really think about it is completely absurd. But I completely understand why that's such an attractive premise.
Jessica Lam Shapiro is with us. She's written a memoir called Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. And it reminded me when reading this of that scene. I think it's from the first Bridget Jones Diary when she sort of throws all of her self-help books in the trash. You know, they're not working for her. She's not getting what she wants. Now, is it that they don't work or that we resist them or we just can't follow through?
You know, I think it's probably a combination of all of those things. There's not a lot of research on the efficacy of self-help. Believe me, I looked. It's not considered to be a very serious science, so they don't do a lot of studies. It's not of big interest to academics. So a lot of it is just sort of hearsay and what you can guess based on buying patterns, which also many book companies don't release their sales statistics. One thing I was able to find out is that the people most likely to buy self-help books are people who have purchased a self-help book in the last 18 months. But how do you interpret that? I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, it's obviously not working because they had to buy another self-help book. On the other hand, you could say, well, maybe it is working. They liked it so much, they went back for more. So, you know, it's just very difficult to know how to interpret even the few statistics that we do have.
You point out that you walked over hot coals, you took a course to overcome your fear of flying, you went to that rules workshop, conferences, helped a friend create a vision board. But talking to your father about your mother's death when you were not even 2 years old was the hardest thing that you'd ever done. How did you get there? How did you decide to take that on?
Well, I have to say it was a self-help book that first kind of cued me in. The subject of my mother's death came up much later in the writing process. When I started writing this book, I was not even thinking about that as relevant. And then at one point I was reading a bunch of self-help books on grieving, which I did find to be some of the more useful books, at least for me, because that was a subject that was something that I did actually need help with. And so when I was reading those books, it made me realize how little my father and I had ever talked about my mother and why it was maybe so difficult for us to do so. And I think just getting more information about that helped me to start talking to him. But it was still very difficult.
It's so interesting that you say that, Jessica, that you hadn't really thought about your mother's death. Because at some point in the book, you point out that maybe self-help is a way of diversion or distracting, of not having to think about the real stuff. Is this where you were headed all along, do you think?
I'm sure a psychologist would say that. I've thought that myself, you know, like was this whole project just some sort of elaborate trick from my brain to get me to start looking in this area that I had been avoiding? I sort of like that theory. It makes me sound, you know, maybe smarter than I am on some level, like at least my unconscious knew what it was doing. My experience of it was really that I was pretty blindsided.
One of the things that came across to me is that a lot of the advice out there is bunk, and it's given by, you know, sort of run-of-the-mill people who just have a story. But you are very careful to say that people get a lot of relief and comfort and hope out of the experience of self-help in its many forms. How about for you? Did you come away feeling more hopeful about the prospect of self-help?
I did, in a sense, you know, in a very narrow sense. I still think there's a lot out there that is just ridiculous, ridiculous advice. But I think that as intelligent people, we're able to go to the bookstore and kind of weed out those books. And if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. If something sounds a little crazy, it probably is. But there are a lot of books that make really reasonable promises and that also say, you know, that they account for different kinds of experience. A lot of the books I liked on grieving said, you know, grief is really unique. No two people grieve the same way. So, you know, here's a bunch of advice. But if you don't find something useful, feel free to ignore it. And if you do find something useful, use it. So that kind of book, I mean, that approach to me is just so reasonable. It was hard to find anything too wrong with it.
Jessica Lam Shapiro, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Lam Shapiro's fiction and nonfiction have been published in The Believer, McSweeney's, and other publications. But for more on her new book, Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, tell us about your own self-help journey.